And now a different take on an old game called Telephone. You know that one where you pass messages from person to person? In this game, this new game, the object is to get a message to another person, someone you don't know, and who lives in another part of the country. Okay, you got that? Now, the only information you have about that person is his or her name, his or her occupation, and the town where he or she lives. And the only way you're allowed to contact that person is to pass along a message to one of your acquaintances you believe would be closer to getting you to delivering that message. It's going to be your acquaintance. And that person, in turn, of course, as the telephone game, is going to pass that message along to an acquaintance, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, how many people, raise your hands, how many people do you think it would take to get a message to that target person? How long would the chain of people be, for example, you think? 10 people? You have to go through 10 people? 20 people? 50 people? 100 people? Would you believe as few as 5 to 7 people on average? And that's what sociologist Stanley Milgram found more than 35 years ago when he did this experiment using the mail system. He was the first to establish and created this now famous 6 degrees of separation we hear about, you know, proving that everyone knows or somewhere you know everybody is separated really by 6 people. It really is a small world after all. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to talk about this experiment and a new one that tries to update it, this time using email. That's right. And when you know, why even spend time and money studying this small world phenomenon? Because it can tell us about real world problems like finding information on a computer network or predicting the spread of disease or the likelihood of a successful job search. It is really a small world after all. If you'd like to talk about this, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you can learn more about our topics, everything that we talk about. Let me introduce my guests. Duncan Watts is the author of 6 Degrees, The Science of a Connected Age, out this year from W.W. Norton. He's also an associate professor of sociology at Columbia University here in New York. He joins us today by phone from the Santa Fe Institute in New Mexico. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Aaron.
You're welcome. John Kleinberg is an associate professor of computer science at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. And he's on the phone today from Fall Creek Studios in Ithaca. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Aaron.
Duncan, tell us about the small world problem, about this experiment.
Well, this is a problem that goes back over 50 years now in sort of the academic literature. And people had tried to think about this sort of mathematically as long ago as the 1950s. But the first person to actually test it was the social psychologist Stanley Milgram. Mm-hmm. And he devised this method that he called the small world method, and that basically we replicate in this current study. And the idea of the small world method is that he chose a single target person who was a stockbroker in Boston, Massachusetts, who lived in Sharon, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, and a few hundred what he called starters, people who he chose, you know, more or less at random from the populations of Boston itself and also from Omaha, Nebraska, which he considered to be socially far more distant from Boston than say, the West Coast, San Francisco or L.A. And these starter people were given some instructions, and they were given a lot of information about this stockbroker, his job, his name, where he lived, his wife's maiden name, his years of military service, and plenty of information to identify the person. But they were told they could only send the message to him if they knew him. And what he meant by that was, you know, roughly speaking, you recognize the person, you remember their name, and they do the same for you. So it's a reasonably weak definition, but all the same, it was very unlikely that someone living in Omaha would know this stockbroker.
Right.
So they had to pass to mail this little packet that he'd given them on to someone they did know, who they thought was closer to the stockbroker than they were. And again, he left that the meaning of that word somewhat vague. Closer could mean geographically closer. It could mean occupationally closer. It could mean all sorts of things. And of the And so, of course, those people got the same set of instructions, and so they passed the message on to another acquaintance. And these message chains percolated their way across the country and through the social strata, and about 20% of them ended up, which was about 60 letters, ended up reaching the stockbroker. And the average length of those chains was about six. And that's, I think, where the phrase 6 degrees of separation came from, although Milgram himself never used that term.
Hmm. And so you tried this with an email, doing this by email?
That's right. We were interested in extending this this study. There were a few things that Milgram did not do that we're interested in. You know, for starters, the pop science that has kind of sprung up around this result has sort of extended the claim to be, you know, anyone in the world can reach anyone else in the world. Well, Milgram didn't really test that. You know, he had a single target person, and he had people starting in just one of two cities. Certainly some people have also criticized the way that he got some of these starter people. It doesn't necessarily seem so random when you look at it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So we were interested in seeing if this could be extended both to more general demographic groups and also to a global scale. And, you know, we're interested not just in whether that number holds up roughly or not, but also in sort of variations around the number. And, you know, are some people easier to reach than others? You know, what sort of barriers are there in the social world that make these messages hard to get through? And we were also interested in looking at an aspect of the problem that that Milgram really didn't think about, which is the question of how people actually find these chains, right? And this is actually a point that John brought up a couple of years ago, that people say, oh, 6 degrees, you know, we're all connected. But that glosses over a very important point, that it's not just that we have these short paths connecting us, but we have to be able to find them. And so when you participate in our experiment, where instead of getting a letter, you go to a website and you sign up, and we give you, instead of just one target, we give you a random choice from about 18 targets that we have scattered around the world, some of them look very hard to reach. You know, you get somebody who has a hard-to-pronounce name in Bandung, Indonesia, and you think, well, you know, this is not quite so obvious. Nevertheless, we find that when people actually, you know, do persist in participating in the experiment, that these message chains can get just about anywhere in only 5 to 7 steps. And that's sort of
wow.
A remarkable thing.
That is. Does that surprise you, John Kleinberg?
Yeah, I find that very surprising. And as Duncan pointed out, it's really surprising in two ways. First, that there really are these short chains. And secondly, that when people are really willing to continue these chains, as Duncan said, when people persist, that they really collectively are able to find them. So no one person can see the message all the way to the end. It isn't like any one of us has a bird's eye view or can anticipate how it's going to get there. But somehow collectively, we're able to funnel the message to these faraway places.
Now, as a computer scientist, you were able to actually model this, correct?
Right. So this was the question that I was interested in, and this was spurred by two things. One was the work that Duncan and his colleague Steve Strogatz did a few years ago, trying to look at models of the small world problem in general, trying to model it as something that happens in networks. In this case, networks of people linked to other people by friendship. And starting from that and just thinking about networks in general, because networks are really pervasive both in sociology and in computer science and across a lot of fields, to ask the problem of how search could happen without global information, right, without any one of us knowing. So we should picture the network not really as a static object. It isn't just a roadmap that you can consult and find paths, but it's really some sort of living, breathing, organic thing that collectively, when you start a message at point A, things ripple through it, information propagates through it, and collectively the network gets the message to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was interested in doing was trying to build models in a very stylized way of how that process could happen.
We're talking about It's a Small World this hour in Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did you find that that the people in searching and in sending these emails out in your computer model, did they behave like anything else? Any, you know, the objects in nature, whatever, and when you make a computer model of it?
I think there were some similarities. So what the model showed was that the ideal network for searching is really one that's balanced between two extremes. So at the one extreme, we have a case where people only know people very close to them. And again, as Duncan said, close could mean several things. It could mean geography. It could mean occupation. But in a world where you only have very close-by contacts, it's just very hard to get the message all the way around the world. You just can't take those long jumps. But it turns out the other extreme, and this was maybe the biggest surprise, that the other extreme is equally difficult. So if you only know people very far away, right? So imagine 10, 20, 50 years forward, you know, to the sort of science fiction view of a completely networked world. We meet people only over the internet. It's sort of a scary concept, and this actually says it would be a problem for this kind of search task, because if you only knew people very far away, then you couldn't really aim the message. Sure, you could get it halfway around the world, but once you get into a local community, how would you take those final steps? And so the ideal network is really one where you have linkage at all scales. You have those faraway friends, right? The friends in Indonesia and in Germany and so forth. But you also have a bunch of friends, you know, in your state, you know, in the vicinity. You also have friends in your town. You have friends on your block. You're friends with your next door neighbors. And so as the message funnels in on the target, you can help advance it regardless of how far along you come into the process. And that very much, I think, resembles things that we see in the way networks are set up and the way social networks are set up.
When you say help advance it, what do you mean by that? You can help it know which, why?
Well, so I guess, so here's a picture. So one of Duncan's subjects was a veterinarian in Norway. And so if I had to get a message to a veterinarian in Norway, I would know, I don't have to actually see the whole path to them, and I couldn't possibly imagine what this path will look like. I just have to know how to make progress. In other words, mm-hmm. how to help advance it. And I would probably do one of two things. I would say, well, I could get closer in geography. So I have a colleague who works with people in Norway a lot. So if I gave it to him, I know it would get to Norway. So I've solved the Norway problem. Now let them solve the veterinarian problem. Or I have another colleague at Cornell whose husband is a veterinarian. I could give it to them. Now I've solved the veterinarian problem, and I'll let them solve the Norway problem, mm-hmm. and I'll hope it gets. And so I've made progress, but a second, maybe more subtle thing has happened, sometimes so subtle that we don't realize it was crucial, that in the process of sending it to Norway or sending it to a veterinarian, I'm banking on the fact that they're more connected among themselves than the entire world is in general. Right. So Norwegians are more likely to know other Norwegians.
All right, we have to pick up that thought because I have to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk about some. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A brief program note. On Monday in this hour, why the Bush administration worries that the next terrorist attack could come not from the skies, but from the sea. Join Neil Conan for a look at the lawlessness of the sea. We're talking this hour about the science of networks with my guest John Kleinberg, Associate Professor of Computer Science at Cornell University, Duncan Watts, author of 6 Degrees, The Science of a Connected Age, out this year from Norton. He's also Associate Professor of Sociology at Columbia University. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. John, you were talking about that second push being important. Once we got our email across the ocean to a foreign community, getting that second person to direct it the correct way was really important.
Right, exactly. So it's crucial that after I've made progress, I've thrown it into an area which is more densely connected. So I hope that Norwegians know other Norwegians more than I know Norwegians, right? At least I hope that's how it works out.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. And so, and then it goes on from there, obviously. Once it gets into the town, you hope people in that town know each other and so forth.
Duncan, do your results tell you that the best strategy to reach a target person in the fewest steps?
Actually, we can get some resolution on that question from the experimental results, and it does seem to follow more or less John's description, but with a slight wrinkle, and that is that when people are geographically very separated from the target, and so the Norwegian vet's a good example. If you're in a different country, the first most obvious thing that you think about is getting it into the right country. Once you get it to the right city, however, say he lives in Oslo, although I don't think he does, but let's say he lives in Oslo, getting it from one neighborhood in Oslo to another is not necessarily a very useful activity. And so what we find is that the first sort of three or four steps of these chains are dominated by geography, people picking their next contact because they consider them geographically closer to the target. Mm-hmm. Once you get beyond, sort of around three or four steps, there's this transition from geography to occupation, where they say, okay, well, we're already sort of in the ballpark geographically, so now we're going to sort of switch dimensions. And actually, that seems to be critical to the way that social networks work, and in fact, why we find this thing so surprising, because we know, people are very multidimensional, and each one of us has a number of characteristics. We have we live in a certain place. We do a certain kind of job. We have certain kinds of hobbies and backgrounds that characterize us. And these things don't necessarily correspond to each other. So, I can be a sociologist in New York, or I can be a sociologist in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And if I live in those different places, I'll have very different geographical characteristics, but I'll still work with the same kinds of people. And we're very good at sort of intuitively switching across from these dimensions. And that's exactly what we see people doing in this experiment. And that, I think, is why it works so well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. That's 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jan in Memphis. Hi, Jan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
This is really interesting. Within the last year, on one of the syndicated NPR shows, there was a woman on who had done a study that disputed the 6 degrees. And I was wondering if one of your guests would have a comment on that.
Sure. The woman you're talking about is Judith Kleinfeld, not to be confused with Kleinberg, who's in the studio here. She raised a couple of points, one of which was which I think was correct, and one of which is a bit misleading. The correct one is that she pointed out that the empirical evidence that that Stanley Milgram had provided in his original studies didn't really support the way that the hypothesis is usually stated. And we know we've already gone through that he had a very restricted kind of study, and so it doesn't really support the claim that anyone in the world can reach anyone else in the world. It's sort of what this really tells us is that people don't read. If you read Stanley Milgram's papers, it's actually very clear what he showed and what he didn't show. Unfortunately, we sort of, everybody hears about this and it becomes folklore and nobody really checks the source anymore. So that was true, and that was certainly one of the reasons why we went about doing this new study. But to say that because the empirical support isn't as convincing as it might be means that it's not true is really sort of to make the same mistake, right? Mm-hmm. That to say, well, I just don't believe this, and no evidence can convince me that it's true. It's a little hard to prove a negative like that. So the best we can do is to make sort of theoretical models about how this ought to work, and to continue to do better and better experiments that test those theories. And at the moment, they seem to be going in lockstep, so we're sort of confident that we're on the right track.
All right, Jan?
Okay, that's great.
Thanks for calling.
Hopeful.
Oh, great.
All right, bye.
Bye. Now, okay, this is an interesting, to many of us, an interesting exercise and an experiment, but what do you do with the knowledge now? What can you do with it practically, moving data or information or whatever around networks? I mean, it seems to me, from just listening to what you're saying, getting that second push going with information is the hardest part. How does this help you move data better now, let's say on a computer or with people or whatever?
Right. Absolutely. I think that one thing that's been very nice about these experiments is that it's given us ways of thinking about how people solve this problem of pushing information through a network, as you said. And this is a very important problem in computer networks also. How do you find information? And one of the things that makes computer science such a difficult field to keep up with, I guess, is that because a lot of it is virtual, we can take a model and very quickly turn that into a design principle for a computer system. And so in recent years, people have actually tried building systems that try to do search in this sort of way, without global knowledge. and in some cases inspired by the notion of small world networks. So if we think about how search is traditionally done on the web right now, say something like
Google.
So right. Google's be probably the best example. Mm-hmm. One thing you have to realize about Google is it's getting 100 million or more queries per day, right? And a staggering number. And so when it gets your query, it doesn't actually have time to go out to the web and look for the answer. And it doesn't do that. It's already sucked down the entire web and has it sitting on an index on their computers. And so it answers your question purely by introspection, by looking at things it's already indexed. It's not actually going out to the web. Now, that's great if you're looking for something that's already in the index. But the problem with the web is it's becoming bigger, it's becoming more dynamic, it's becoming more heterogeneous. And it's really an open question whether this style, this design principle, is going to keep up indefinitely. Will we always be able to gobble down the whole web and look things up locally? Or eventually, will we have to leave things where they are because they're just too big and they change too rapidly, and we'll have to actually go out and look for the answers? And at that point, we sort of tumble from a world of directory assistance, of 411 lookup and so forth, to the world of the Milgram experiment, and to the experiment that Duncan was recreating. Because now, in response to a question, we actually have to go out into the network and try to find the best path to the information. And you're starting to see that with things like peer-to-peer file sharing systems, for example. Right? So the things on which people share MP3 files and right. and so forth, that it quickly, after the demise of Napster, for example, or the demise of Napster's centralized initial solution, it became infeasible to have this central index where you stored pointers to everything centrally. And so the current generation of systems does things in a much more small world kind of way, a much more 6 degrees kind of way. When you want to look something up that's residing on someone else's machine, you actually try to find a path through the network to them.
Mm-hmm. And this is the trend of the future then? Because we're going to be more decentralized?
I think we're going to be more decentralized. Things are bigger. So,
right.
I mean, the web is enormous, but the total amount of information on everybody's personal home computers is much, much more enormous.
Right.
It's orders of magnitude bigger.
There's an analog to all this in the social world that we're actually very familiar with, and it comes about when we try and solve problems. So, you know, most of the U.S. economy these days is not a production economy. It's essentially a problem-solving economy. So many of us in our daily lives have to find the answers to questions, and they're often questions that we haven't encountered before. So if the question is something very straightforward, like, find the email address for John Kleinberg at Cornell University, you know, that's something we can go look up in a directory, and it's relatively trivial. You don't have to go and ask your friends. But if the question is much more ambiguous, as it often is, like, you know, find someone who knows something about, the applications of sociology to computer science, right? You know, that's not something that's very easy to look up on Google. And so when questions are ambiguous like that, we often have to use our social resources. And we do this all the time. We do this at work. We do this when we're looking for jobs. We do this when we're trying to meet people. And so I think that in addition to having some interesting applications outside of sociology, experiments like this shed some light on the kinds of things that we actually do every day. Mm.
Talking about networking this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Sally in North Virginia. Hi, Sally.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I was very happy I got to participate in this online study.
You were sending emails out?
Yeah, I actually got hit twice with the same target, and I was so frustrated that I couldn't get through farther than I did. Apparently the person I was supposed to find had worked at the same company I had worked at or was still working there. It was unclear. In the same small division, apparently, unless they had changed positions after leaving the company. And I had people inside the company sending it back out to me to try to find this person. And she lived up in New York, and I finally, on the second try, just threw it up to somebody that I knew that lived up in New York. So it was rather frustrating to try to feel that I had only one chance. I got two chances, but one chance to make the connection as opposed to doing some kind of broadcast or shotgun method out to everybody that it could have been applicable.
Right.
And I'm wondering, when you talk about modeling for computer networks, you know, when you're doing like internet connections for emails and Google and things, whether you know, they all necessarily have to be single shot, or whether it's possible to broadcast and see how far each possibility goes.
Right. That's a great question.
I got about a minute to answer it, so go ahead.
Okay. So if we're thinking about things that don't have an index, like Google, but things have to go out to the network, so your question is, it's frustrating to have just one try. Why not broadcast to all your friends? And to a limited extent, that is what a lot of these systems do. And the challenge is that that approach doesn't scale very far. It'll scale for a few steps, but if you keep asking all of your friends or all your neighboring computers, and they ask all their neighboring computers, then you don't really have a search. You have a computer virus. You have something that floods the network. And so the challenge is how to get multiple attempts without it growing like an epidemic and bogging down the entire network. And that's a very interesting research problem.
Hmm. Sal, you'd rather try it again some other way.
Oh, I would love to have the opportunity to try yet another possibility.
We do have a new version of the experiment up, Sally, at smallworld.columbia.edu. And this version, we do, in fact, allow you to pick a second or even a third person you want to forward it on to. So if you go and try again, your desires will be answered.
Is everyone welcome to try that?
Absolutely. We sincerely hope that everybody tries it. You know, this is a sort of unusual science experiment in that it requires the participation of the general population for us to actually figure out what's going on.
All right. Well, we'll send everybody from our website to your website. And
expect
the flood. Thank you for joining us. Duncan Watts, author of 6 Degrees, The Science of a Connected Age, out this year from Norton. He's also associate professor of sociology at Columbia here in New York. John Kleinberg, associate professor of computer science at Cornell University in Ithaca. Thank you also for joining us today.
Thanks, Ara.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Erica Holland, and Annalise Strachan, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. And today we say a fond farewell and happy birthday to Erica. Aw, she's produced a number of the interviews you heard this summer, and we're going to miss her contributions to Science Friday. Of course, she's heading back to school and getting some real work in instead of working for us. Best of luck, Erica, to you. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. And if you missed any of the links, now, if you want to get in on this new email search, you can go over to sciencefriday.com, and we'll have links to the Columbia site, and you can try your 6 degrees of separation and see how well it works for you. Also, Science Friday Kids Connection is up there with a new award that we won for the good content that we put up there in Kids Connection. Go to our website and get free information and teaching curricula for your schools. Ira Flatow in New York.